This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest today is Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. Chuck has written extensively on income inequality and is author of several books, including 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. He has co-founded numerous initiatives, including Wealth for the Common Good, now merged with the Patriotic Millionaires, United for a Fair Economy, and Divest Invest. Chuck Collins is here to tell us about his most recent book, Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good, published in 2016. Welcome, Chuck.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Diane. It's
great to have you here. What led you to write your book? What's your purpose?
Well, I've been looking at these issues of inequality for 30 years, but I hadn't fully told the story of how I myself grew up in the 1% and have some insight into how wealth is multiplying for the advantaged and how disadvantaged is multiplying for everyone else. So while this book isn't a memoir, it draws on my own stories as well as more stories of people who talk about their wealth in a different way than you're used to hearing, probably.
Would you say more about what you mean by born on third base?
Yeah, it's from a quote, actually, from the governor of Texas, Ann Richards, who once said about George W. Bush that he was born on third base but claimed he had hit a triple. So it's, you know, it's acknowledging, in my case, that I have advantages. I didn't just get to where I was in my 20s on my own. I was born essentially into inherited wealth.
Would you say more about the ways in which you were personally born on third base and the journey that led you to give away your inherited wealth?
Well, I grew up in a very affluent suburb of Detroit, Michigan, called Bloomfield Hills. It's where all the executives of the auto industry lived. And my great-grandfather was the meatpacker Oscar Mayer. So I was like the fourth generation in a very successful meatpacking family and kind of an iconic brand. And that meant that there was quite a bit of wealth that actually flowed to my family and to me. So at the age of 21, my parents gave me a trust fund so that I could both pay for my education, but there was quite a bit of money left over. So all those were advantages I had.
What's wrong with the class antagonism strategy of fighting inequality?
Well, for many years, I used to be part of the perspective that we needed to kind of engage people in class anger toward the wealthy in order to build a movement. But at this point, I don't feel like that will get us the transformation we need, that actually there are many wealthy potential allies and allies that could be brought into this work.
In your book, you speak about the need for a more accurate narrative about how wealth is achieved. Would you explain?
Yeah, I think there's a common story when people learn about the inequality, you know, the wealthiest 1% have 40% of all the private wealth. Some people say, oh, well, that's okay because those people work harder or they deserve their wealth. And the sort of corollary of that is people are poorer than they deserve to be where they are. And my point is that actually the extreme inequalities we're living through are really not linked to merit or individual effort. They're kind of deep structural changes. So a big part of what I'm trying to do in this book is actually tell a more complicated story about how wealth comes about, meaning that, yes, individual effort may be part of it, but it's also part of this sort of public investments and institutions and help and luck and all these other factors that contribute to individual wealth. And part of the way I do that is through stories. I tell stories of people who actually, you know, would be considered iconic and successful people, but they tell their story from how they got all the help that got them where they are.
Would you like to give an example?
Well, one person is a guy named Martin Rothenberg, who was one of the defenders of the estate tax. And actually, I worked with Bill Gates' dad and a whole bunch of Seattle Microsoft millionaires as part of a campaign to preserve the estate tax. But this one guy, Martin, basically, he told his story of, you know, he was born in a low-income community. His parents weren't wealthy, but he went to great schools and public libraries that were open on the weekend. Someone else paid for his education, for his college education. He got a free ride. He went into high tech, which was built through public investment. So he sort of tells his own personal success story of through the perspective of how society really was the major factor in helping him become wealthy.
How does privilege affect the lens through which we view society and our achievements?
Well, in some ways, I feel like privilege is it's kind of a disconnection drug. In my case, I can say, you know, you grow up in a wealthy bubble and you learn pretty quickly that, you know, that most people's experience is quite different than your own. There's this fair amount of suffering and deprivation in some cases. So one of the ways privileged people deal with that is by disconnecting, by not being part of the struggles and experiences of people. And even Michael Jordan, the great basketball player, as he became wealthy, he described how his world became smaller and how he became more and more distrustful of people around him. And I think that's a common experience.
What advantages accrue to the 1% beyond financial wealth?
Well, there's the advantage of just stability and security, and in some cases over several generations, that enables children and grandchildren to also take advantage of opportunities. So there's a sort of like intergenerational flow. There are social networks. There's sort of the sense of, well, in my case, I can say growing up in kind of a healthy environment with a lot of recreation and open space and places to play and stimulating childcare experiences. So all these things sort of add up to a mountain of advantages.
Would you speak about how affluent families undermine equal opportunity by providing advantages to their children?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, really today, families in the top, I would say like 10%, the wealthiest 10%, give their kids all kinds of head starts. From the moment they're born, maybe before they're born, they are getting in a whole range of enrichment experiences and tutoring and help when they have trouble, and they're prepared for school in different ways, and then they're prepared for college and jobs. And that would be fine. Parents help their kids. That's what parents do. But if the society isn't able to make up the difference for non-wealthy people, then the gap keeps growing. And that's kind of what's happening today. Someone who doesn't have family wealth is taking on more student debt, having to work a job instead of doing an unpaid internship in their field of study. Those are just lots of ways in which the gap gets reinforced thanks to family wealth.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Chuck Collins, author of the book Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you call the generation that returned from World War II the greatest subsidized generation. Would you explain?
Yeah, you know, a big part of why we have some of these inequalities is that after World War II, we as a society made a huge investment in building a middle class, primarily for white people. So 1945 to 1977, you know, debt-free GI Bill, college education, very low interest subsidized mortgages for first-time homebuyers. I mean, imagine it today, a 40-year 1% fixed rate mortgage. That's what a lot of people got in the 50s. Those put families on a kind of wealth building express train. And yet, in my conversations with people, people don't always realize just how big of a subsidy that was. And that phrase, actually, I was interviewing a World War II veteran who said, you know, I guess I'm part of the greatest subsidized generation, because he really saw all the ways in which he got help just to get kind of in the middle class and on the way to wealth building.
And in what ways did people of color miss out on these subsidies?
Well, the largely unknown story is that many returning war veterans who were African American or Latino returned to a very segregated or Jim Crow education system in the South. They weren't able to get the debt-free college educations, and the mortgage programs were highly discriminatory. So Federal Housing Administration mortgage insurance was almost underwritten. The darker your skin, the less likely you would get the loans. And that was really the practice for almost 30 years. So while white families got on the express train to wealth, African American and Latino and Native First Nations people were basically sort of waiting at the station for the train that never showed up.
Say more about how these subsidies affect future generations.
Well, here's one example. I mean, today, the home ownership rate for a white household is 71%. For African-American households, it's 41%. So the past really shows up in the present in the form of wealth, home ownership, savings. So even right up to the current moment, we see how the legacy of racism in wealth building really plays out today.
In what ways does charitable giving fall short in intervening in an unequal system?
Well, people kind of think, oh, well, the wealthy are generous and they give back through foundations, which is true. But what we're seeing is wealthy people using philanthropy as a way to reduce their taxes and then creating family foundations that may or may not really meet the greatest civic good. So part of my point is philanthropy is not a substitute for paying your fair share of taxes. And now we're seeing some charitable giving, it almost sort of is worsening inequality. For instance, subsidizing public schools in affluent communities or subsidizing kind of research and campaigning that actually undermines the public interest. So philanthropy is not the answer to these problems of inequality.
To what extent does philanthropy take away from public funding and tax collection?
It's substantial. I mean, if you're in the top tax bracket, you know, and you pay a 39% income tax or whatever, something like that, for every donation you give, for every dollar, about 40 to 50 cents of that is contributed by the rest of us in the form of lost tax revenue. And over 10 years, it's about $75 billion a year in revenue that's lost because of the charitable deduction. And yet, here's $75 billion. If it was government spending, we would be scrutinizing it. But because it's the charitable sector, there's almost no accountability.
How can philanthropy be changed to better promote equality?
Well, I think there's a number of things we could do. One is donors could really look at how to fund change, not just traditional charity, really get at the root causes of problems. But we should also kind of update the laws governing foundations. They should not be allowed to warehouse wealth for decades. They probably should have a rule saying they have to pay out a little bit more than they currently are. Right now, foundations can count overhead, their offices and salaries and planning retreats on Caribbean islands or whatever. They can deduct that from their payout rate, the legally required amount of money that they have to put out the door. And so you have a lot of foundations that end up being particularly cushy deals for family members and children and siblings who work at the foundation, and very little money is actually getting out on the street.
How receptive are the 1% to helping address inequality?
Well, part of the reason I wrote Born on Third Base is to say that I think there's a lot more receptiveness than people might think. There is a segment of the 1% that kind of use their wealth and power to rig the rules to get more wealth and power. But there's a huge number of unengaged and potential allies there. And I see that. I see wealthy people, whether they're in the 1% or to the top 5%, who are kind of waiting to be invited to being part of the solutions that we need to engage with.
Would you describe the different subgroups within the 1% and which subgroups are most likely to be receptive to reducing inequality?
Yeah. In the book, I describe a kind of what I call a roadmap to Richistan. And there's sort of several tiers. I mean, if you think at the very top, there's sort of the billionaires and the what I call upper richistan, you know, people with net worth over $15 million. Their circumstances are very, very different. Sometimes they might be hard to reach or connect with, but they're also more stable and comfortable. They're less worried about their children slipping backwards, whereas lower richistan, maybe a household with $1 million or $2 million in net worth, is needing to spend a lot of money to make sure their children's economic status doesn't decline. So they're less interested in changing the rules to make the economy work for everybody, and they're very particularly interested in just protecting what they have. So I think once you get above a certain threshold, then you can kind of engage people on these questions of, you know, is this the kind of country we want to live in? Are these inequalities really good for anybody? And that's part of the case that I try to make is, look, too much inequality is actually bad for everybody, including the very wealthiest groups.
What role can those at the top play in making our society more equitable?
Well, I think one thing that's very important is to tell true stories about the origins of wealth, to sort of disrupt this mythology of deservedness that we sometimes hear. So instead of telling the great man story of how I did it alone, to really be upfront and talk about the forms of help that people get, I think speaking out for fair economic policies, raise the minimum wage, increase taxes on those with the greatest capacity to pay, reduce the influence of money on politics. We need wealthy people to sort of be out there advocating, supporting the organizing that's already happening and campaigning for those policy changes. And then I say, pay your fair share of taxes and share deeply and bring the wealth home is one of the things I really encourage. Invite the wealthy to bring their wealth home, take it out of the offshore tax havens and the global financial casino and bring the wealth back to the communities that are trying to, you know, build healthy, local, resilient communities. That seems to be a very powerful way that the wealthy can support healthy local communities.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Chuck Collins, author of the book Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes a Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. Would you say more about how wealth can be brought home?
Well, there's a lot of wealth that's sort of, I call it disconnected wealth. It's invested in a way, it's in the fossil fuel sector that's kind of, you know, hell-bent on bringing us to a climate catastrophe. It's in Wall Street investments that are trying to get high returns, but a lot of those are disconnected from the real economy. So bringing wealth home is sort of saying, let's put money in the real economy of goods and service. Take it out of the fossil fuel sector and invest it in the new energy economy, for example. So those are some of the ways that bringing wealth home, but it's also sort of like bringing your whole stake in a place, bringing your whole passion and putting your stake in ensuring that a place is as good a place for your children as it is for everybody else's children, or vice versa.
Would you comment on the results of opting in versus opting out of public services?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that happens with wealthy folks is we withdraw from the services that everyone else depends on. You know, so we don't use the local park. We are part of a private recreation club. We don't use the schools. Our kids go to private schools. And the more wealthy people sort of opt out, they not only take their money out of the system, they sometimes take their stake in it working for everybody. And, you know, my kids grew up going to the Boston Public Schools. They went to the local swimming pool, which sometimes was kind of a drag, you know, because there wasn't a lifeguard there. The facilities weren't very good. But that meant I had an actual stake in making that system better. And I think that's, you know, when somebody who has privilege or social capital networks, I knew the mayor, I knew city councilors, I could kind of become the squeaky wheel and make something work better for everybody. So that's what it really means, I think, to have a stake.
Would you give some additional examples of individuals in the 1% who are working to promote equality?
Yeah, I work very closely with Bill Gates Sr., the founder of Microsoft, for almost a decade, publicly campaigning to preserve the estate tax, and here in Washington State and other places, keeping the estate tax alive and linked to education. I also, as part of this Patriotic Millionaires Network, there's people like Warren Buffett and George Soros and George Zimmer, the head of Men's Warehouse, and Agnes Gund, who's a big art collector at the Museum of Metropolitan Art. You know, so there are people who are both old wealth and entrepreneurial wealth, first generation wealth, who are kind of actively speaking out for a fairer economy.
Would you tell us about the Patriotic Millionaires?
Yeah, the Patriotic Millionaires is a kind of a fascinating group. There's, you know, a couple hundred CEOs and business leaders and wealthy individuals, and they are very public. They're willing to talk to the media. They're willing to stand up with legislators and support campaigns and legislation. We've been working a lot on raising the minimum wage. We've, in the last year, done a lot to eliminate some of the tax loopholes that the wealthy use, like the carried interest loophole and some of these offshore loopholes. So they're a group of wealthy people saying, look, it's not in our interest to see these inequalities keep growing, and we need to publicly speak out.
How do you go about recruiting new members?
Well, in some ways, it's people working their own networks, their own families, their own business networks, and inviting them to join. And ironically, people don't like the name patriotic millionaires. It sounds a little bit like bragging, but everyone understands it's kind of a compelling media brand. People want to talk to the patriotic millionaires. The members of Congress want to meet and do lobby days with us. And so we're all kind of willing to go along with that powerful name.
How do you find you're received by the 99% groups that promote equality?
Well, we make it very clear that our job is to validate the work that they're doing and support the existing organizing. So we're not sort of off on our own. We work very closely with networks and campaigns that are working for fair taxes. For instance, in New Jersey, there was an effort to abolish the state-level estate tax. And our Patriotic Millionaires Network and members who were in New Jersey got really involved in becoming part of the spokespeople for defending the estate tax. So a lot of the work is in service and in support of existing efforts.
What advice do you give to the 99%? How can the 99% or regular citizens best help address inequality?
Well, I think one thing is to organize to defend your own livelihood and your community against sort of these forces of extractive capitalism that we're facing right now. That said, my advice would be don't forget that there are potential allies there. Not all wealthy people, not everyone in the 1% are selfish and greedy and are trying to, you know, buy a prescription drug and jack up the price 5,000%. There are many people, I think, who actually are quite behind the scenes or are quite willing to kind of be engaged and brought into the table if they're reached out to in a way that isn't antagonistic. So my advice is realize there may be some allies in the room and there may be some potential allies not that far away for the work that you're doing.
Would you like to also comment on empathy? You mentioned that as being an approach that might be particularly effective.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's somewhat of a lack of empathy in lots of ways, but I guess I'm inviting people to look at the experience of wealthy people with a little bit of empathy. I understand certainly sometimes the anger and rage and impatience, but in this case, I think many wealthy people are kind of forcibly disconnected from the rest of society. Certainly if you're raised in that wealthy kind of family, you're told to be afraid of contact with outsiders. And if you look at it from a global perspective, most of us here in the United States are in sort of the global 1 to 5%, you know? So we should think about the wealthy in the same way that maybe someone in Bangladesh looks at us, which is, you know, we're waiting to be engaged in a way that taps into our talents.
What do you see as the key barriers to change in successfully addressing inequality?
Well, I think there's both the stories of inequality that justify inequality that we talked about and the need to change those. And then I think there's sort of the power to change that. And, you know, it's very hard to imagine in our current political environment, certainly at the national level, pushing forward with an agenda that would dramatically reduce student debt and reduce inequality and raise wages. But states and localities are doing all kinds of things, even in states where voters both voted for Donald Trump, they also voted to raise the minimum wage. So I think there's a huge appetite for campaigns to reduce inequality. And I think the good news is there's sort of a realignment happening.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, I hope to crack open more real conversations about class and inequality. And I hope to engage both more wealthy people, and I'm talking to lots of groups of philanthropic donors and young heirs and heiresses. So I'm talking to those groups as well as the public, just to sort of have a more thoughtful, nuanced discussion about how we can engage those with wealth and see them as potential allies in a movement to reduce inequality.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I hope that you will check out my book or check out our website, inequality.org, which is kind of the portal for research on this. And talk to each other. You know, I think there's a certain amount of taboos around talking about money and class. And if you know people who are either in the 1% or if you're fortunate to be in that group, to just talk to others about their experience. Start breaking the rules a little bit around telling true stories.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Chuck.
Thanks, Diane, for having me.
You were just listening to Chuck Collins, author of the book, Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good, published in 2016 by Chelsea Green Publishing. For more information, check on the web at inequality.org. Again, that's inequality.org. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.